Welcome to the Maker's Quest podcast. I am Greg Porter.
And I'm Brian Benham. And today we are talking about trade shows and arts and craft shows and what they can do for your business. So, Greg, you just got back from a guitar show, or was it a guitar tool show? I guess I should have clarified that before we hit record.
Guitar show is the right term.
All right. So how did that go? Did that help boost a lot of business and introduce your product to new people?
It did, and I'll kind of back up a little bit and define what a guitar show is, because the first time I got invited, one of my buddies called. He's like, "Hey, do you want to go to a guitar show?" And I was like, "I don't even know what that means." And it sounds simple enough, but through my mind, I was like, "Well, is it like a car show where people bring their guitar and they polish them up and shine them up and they talk to people about their instrument? You know, what is it?" And I went. Not as a vendor, I went as just an attendee, but I didn't know what I was going to see or, you know, what went on there. And, but what a guitar show is essentially if you build guitars or if you collect them and want to sell them, or if you have anything to do with, say like guitar straps or slides or amplifiers or pedals or anything else that has something to do with guitars, you can get a booth and you can display them. For sale, or if you do custom things, you can just show off your work so that people understand what kind of things you offer. And for those who don't know, I have a company called Skyscraper Guitars, and we make tools for people who repair and build guitars. And that is a very, very, very niche type of a business. There's maybe a handful, maybe at most two handfuls of companies doing that in the United States that I'm aware of anyway. And so having an opportunity to introduce our brand name, I guess would be the way to say it, and our product line to new customers. Interestingly enough, if you know, the guitar show is full of a bunch of builders, and those are our customers. It's not the attendees who come through the door to look at everything. It's actually the people who have booths or tables set up. Those are our target audience. And so we meet a lot of people in the hour before the show starts and during teardown. And that's where I don't know if I want to say we do a ton of business actually, but we make a lot of really solid contacts. And we track some of those over time. And since it's that guitar show was in Colorado, we track sales, you know, from Colorado to see who's buying our stuff. And usually we see a pretty decent uptick in, you know, in the weeks following those shows. So we do, it's kind of wild. We do a point of sale at the shows, and we've made enough money to cover our time and our travel and the expense of actually buying the booth. So that's been wonderful. The connections that we make, you know, you can, every once in a while, we'll get an email. "Hey, so-and-so met you at the Colorado Guitar Show, and he told me about your stuff. And, you know, so I'm ordering some things." And so we'll hear things like that with Instagram and some other types of social media. We'll get comments on there. "Hey, it was great to meet you." And then you'll see that person's name show up sometime soon on your customer list. But it was great. You know, and so much of conventions and trade shows for me are just the relationship part. There's the money and ringing up sales, and that's great. But meeting people, connecting dots, you know, when you're involved in such a small group of people who build and repair guitars, that industry is a very small industry nationwide. And being able to connect dots for people, "Hey, so-and-so knows this person and could really use help in this department," or whatever it is. So from that perspective, I think I would call that show pretty successful. There's, I'll say, you know, as things go, there are things at trade shows and conventions that are good and bad. and you can probably imagine at a guitar show, there are people who want to try out their guitars and amplifiers, and they want to try them out at ear-splitting volumes. And that's great that they can hear that guitar or that amplifier or whatever it is at stage volume. The issue is when you have 20 people in the same room doing that, it makes it almost impossible as a vendor to talk to people who have questions about what it is that you do. And you can imagine the questions that come in are fairly technical questions. So it could be quite challenging in an atmosphere like that to try to conduct business. We, of course, handed out a ton of business cards. And, you know, you're constantly telling people, just drop me an email and we can talk that way. If we need to hop on Zoom to visually discuss a problem, you know, point at things on a guitar that either aren't working right or you can't get sorted out. But there's some important things to be aware of at trade shows. And I would assume woodworking is a very similar thing in that, you know, understanding who your target audience is and how to sell to them is important. Have you got any experience there, Brian, that you can share with us that might be helpful?
I kind of wanted to grill you on a few questions first, though, before we jumped into what I got going on with trade shows. But so when you said the before and the after, is that picking up a lot of business to business type?
Yeah,
clientele?
Absolutely. You nailed it there. I never think of the right words when I'm describing things. Right. But yeah. So, you know, people show up at those things. If you're in the market for a guitar or an amplifier, you know, most people are going to go to Guitar Center or somewhere, you know, Sam Ash, somebody like that, right? And buy something off the shelf if they're looking for something for their kid. When they show up to a guitar show, they're looking for something vintage, something rare, something unique to catch their eye. And generally they show up with a wad of cash that could choke a horse because, you know, if there's a $5,000 or $10,000 guitar that they want to be able to flash the cash in front of the person selling it because that motivates a lot of sellers. If you're asking 10 grand for something and somebody pulls out a wad of $900 bills and says, will you take 9,000 instead of 10? Most people see that stack of cash and go, yep. and so you have individuals there wanting to make a deal. And those aren't the people who are my customers because they're generally not somebody who repairs guitars or who does that. They're a collector of guitars or they're another music shop that's there to get a good supply of stuff for them to take back and sell in their showroom or what have you. When I look at the people who buy from us, most of them are guitar technicians, repair people, builders. And, you know, some of them come over and they're like, yeah, somebody just bought this $9,000 guitar I had for sale. And I've really been wanting your set of radius beams. How much are those? And, you know, well, good for you. They're only $8,900. But we do have people like that. And I actually, you know, for instance, I met a guitar store owner. He came up and spent a pretty decent amount of money with me because he had five technicians that work on guitars in his shop. And he's like, man, I could really use, back to the radius beams, I could really use a full set of long radius beams to, you know, for my guys to do fretwork and things like that. And, you know, it's the type of thing where somebody can save, I want to say those cost about $50 to ship them because they're super big and they're heavy and, you know, they're just a hard item to ship. And so, you know, he wound up getting a heck of a deal just being there in person and being able to buy them from me. But yeah, we see a lot of business to business. That's a good way to describe it.
Yeah. So the connection makes it worth it after the fact. Yeah. So in the woodworking world, there's a couple of different types of shows you can do. One is like if you are maybe a YouTuber that wants to sell your plans or whatever, you might go to a woodworking show where there's a lot of equipment being sold. But the ones that I tend to try to focus on are like art gallery type shows and arts and crafts shows and things like that. Izzy Swan introduced me to a design conference in Jackson Hole, Wyoming that he highly suggested that I check out. And I went up there and it was definitely a reality check of what I need to do to be able to play at that level, because just to rent a booth there is a couple thousand dollars. So it was not so expensive. And then all the, I got to have furniture to show. So then there's weeks of labor and materials and all that. So I have not yet done that show, but I've gone up there a couple of times during it. And I'm not really sure how I feel about it now over the years, of visiting the show, because it's, since it is so expensive, people like me can't necessarily afford it. And so it's become more of the big furniture manufacturers and the gutter guy, the guy selling the gutters. And it's turned into more of a home show of sorts than it is an art show anymore. There's very few artists there, unfortunately. Yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about that, if I'm going to continue to try to pursue that as a goal or not. Maybe it'll pendulum will swing back the other way.
Well, so my question there would be, and I did this last year a little bit, but there was a guy who's actually a client of mine. I work on his guitars, and he had a product that he wanted to sell. And he's like, yeah, I was thinking about getting a booth. And I wound up telling him, I'm like, just set him in my booth. You know, we got plenty of space. Just take up some residency. But I wonder on something that, the cost of the guitar show is nowhere near $2,000 a booth. It's a tenth of that. But I wonder, you know, would it make sense? And maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't, for an artist to maybe split that with another artist to get, you know, bring that barrier of entry down a little bit. I feel like, you know, Jackson Hole has a really good audience in terms of people that have some expendable income, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And probably also appreciate the arts.
Yeah. So splitting a booth, that would be, you'd have to play it right, because they have their booth rules and things on how that works. So I might team up with maybe one of my interior design clients to where she would get the booth and then I would be a vendor of hers showing in her booth, kind of a thing. I think we could get around something like that. You. But yeah, gotcha. Yeah. So, but in the meantime, I've been doing some like just some local art gallery type things, local art stuff, little local showings, to try to get some more local business going on and enter, you know, just get more into the art community. And one thing that I've noticed that really has helped my reach in those kind of things, because a lot of people are going there to buy maybe gifts and some of the lower end stuff, is to make sure that I have like something like postcards that have like my products on it that they can walk away with it, because not very many people are prepared to walk away with a custom piece of furniture out there because it's big and all that. And that way they can contact me.
I was going to say, so let's just talk about that for a second. If you've got a booth like that, you've definitely got it, depending on the venue, right? But there's sort of different classifications of customers that walk through your booth. There are the people who are interested in the arts, but probably aren't going to spend any money on the things. They just want to see it. It's like they're going to a free gallery show.
Mm-hmm. Right?
There's that group of people. There's the other group of people who are very interested in art, that maybe don't have a ton of money, but they want to support artists in whatever way they can. And, you know, these are the people that you see all the time, support local music, support local art. And then you probably have people that might walk around that may wind up buying something, but from one person, you know, like let's find that one thing that we're going to take home and put on the wall. And then you have other people that show up there and they're trying to decorate an entire house. And they're just, I want that, I want that, I want that, I want that, right? And my question is, when you set up a booth like that, do you set it up with different price points of things that you're selling to engage those different groups of people? So it might be the coaster, the cutting board, and then, you know, on up to here's a really nice table that you could buy for $5,000.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. So I set my booth up kind of like a little bit of a U. And the stuff up front will be like a desk or a side table or end table, maybe a coat rack, something that's big and stands up to kind of attract people in. And also those are the prime things. And then I'll maybe have some cutting boards, clocks. I make these little wall hanging clocks that have a patina metal in the background. Those are pretty popular. So I'll have those. And then I'll just have some really just cheap stuff, you know, the cutting boards, the little boxes and all that kind of stuff. Because one thing When you go to any arts and crafts type fair, there'll be five or six woodworkers, and all five or six woodworkers downloaded the exact same CNC file. And so they all have the exact same thing trying to sell, because I don't know. Even though there's no tax on creativity, people seem to act like there is a tax and not want to pay it. So they go for the easy buck, and then they don't sell anything.
Yeah. The wolf howling at the moon, the guy with the funny spiked hair playing the clarinet or whatever it is. Yeah. I've seen those. Interesting. Well, I asked that, Brian. You can imagine at the guitar show, it's the same with us, right? We have some tools that are very expensive. I mean, you can get up into, you know, we just released a whole series of acoustic guitar building tools. And, you know, some of those things are in the $1,000 range, right? There's not a lot of people who are going to walk by and just accidentally drop $1,000 on you. But we do have a lot of tools that for players, not necessarily technicians, that are in that $20 to $30 range. And it's amazing how many of those you'll sell. And interestingly enough, at 20 bucks a pop, excuse me, if you sell 10 things at 20 bucks a pop, that's 200 bucks. You know, that's a pretty nothing to sneeze at, you know, when you're looking at covering your expenses for the day, being able to fill in some of that revenue with some of those smaller items, just high volume, small item is a good strategy for things work.
Yeah, for sure. That kind of goes back to my little postcard things, that getting people to remember me when I come back. And I mentioned in a past podcast that I make these little games, these little 3D puzzle, wooden puzzle things. And a lot of times I'll just give those away to kids that are just going by, just, you know, it's got my logo on it. Hey, I remember that guy that gave our kid this thing, you know, just to keep anything I can do to keep them to remember my name or remember me in some meaningful way once they leave the show. You know, like in the future when they're like, hey, you know, we should get a new coffee table, and then they may have this tucked away in a book or something like that. Offline, we had talked about a 3D printer that you got, a resin printer.
Oh, yeah.
Can you resin print a guitar pick?
You could.
Would it sound okay?
It'd probably be all right. Yeah. I hadn't even thought about that, but yeah.
Okay. So my thought is that you resin print a guitar pick that has a skyscraper logo on, and then that's just, what do they call that when you have a little goodie bag of stuff at shows? I can't, there's a technical name for that.
Is there? Okay.
A goodie bag, swag bag.
Swag bag. So, okay. Yeah.
When you're given it, you could give stuff away for a swag bag, and then they got a guitar pick to remember your now, tools by.
We do have, and this one is one that I use, so it's just sitting here on my desk. We do have guitar picks with our logo in foil on them that we send those out with a lot of our products, have those just kind of in, if we send it out in a Ziploc bag. So some of our smaller stuff, they always have guitar picks in there, and that's something, number one, interest, you know, you look at what you give away, and people will sometimes ask like, why this? And we have a black pick and an orange pick. And of course, I don't have an orange one by me. The orange one is very thick, the orange one is very thin, and the black one is very thick. And people always ask, well, why these two? And I say, well, the black one is actually my favorite style of pick. I've played with these for years. And so, you know, I get them custom printed because if I like them, I feel like there might be some other people. And the orange one is because our color is orange. That was what was available, was a thin pick, but it's a good conversation starter. But at the trade shows that we go to, we always put out picks, business cards, and stickers. We have, you know, our skyscraper guitar logo. And that's another thing we put in a lot of our products, is stickers for people. You know, if you have that toolbox or whatever, a lot of technicians have a toolbox that they keep things in. We want our name to be front and center if possible.
So you're way ahead of me on my train of thought of it. You're already.
Well, and the other thing that we didn't do this year. Last year we took a big bowl of candy, and that was a huge hit. You know, like you're saying with puzzles, it was all the little kids, because you can imagine being a little kid getting drugged through a guitar show. There is nothing there for you. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to play with. There's nowhere that you can run because God forbid you knock something over that costs $10,000.
Right.
And so we had a little candy dish out and, you know, people would always, can I take one for my kid? It's like, take a handful. It's like the right. bag costs $3. Go for it. Like, just take as many as you want. And anyway, we'd see those people circle back around with their kids about a half hour later to get more chocolate to keep them happy.
Yeah, that candy thing's a big deal. I don't know if you remember Jack at Austin Hardwoods. He passed away, unfortunately. But when my kids were young and they went with me to the lumber yard, they would want to wait for Jack to ring us up because Jack gave them lollipops.
Of course he did.
Yes.
Jack. Ah, yep. I miss him. You know, yeah. there's certain people that make your day. I'll tell my Jack story for all the listeners. Jack was a pretty unique kind of guy. Like when you met him, you realized you were meeting somebody that was a little bit more unique than your average person.
Mm-hmm, and for sure.
He was always super into what you were buying and why you were buying it. And I think, you know, that was kind of what fueled his life a little bit, was he lived vicariously through other people's projects. And every time Jack would ring me up, he'd say, hey, do you have an account here? Yeah, I have an account. What's the account name? Skyscraper Guitars. He's like, oh, do you ever build guitars for James Hetfield from Metallica? And I would always standard answer, like I'd never heard the question before, just because, you know, why bother? And I'm always like, yeah, you know, I've not built any for James or Kirk. And he'd go, oh man, there was this one guy who used to come in here all the time and he built guitars for Metallica. I'm like, that's awesome. You know, right. Anyway, Jack would tell me that every time I went in there and I would just oblige him, let him tell the story. Yeah. I didn't care. So yeah. Anyway, we missed good, Jack.
Good guy. My kids loved him. Loved the suckers. The lollipops.
I could totally see him doing that too. That's awesome. Back to the conversation. Let's talk a little bit about, I've got some questions about the gallery game. And I know you show stuff in galleries. I don't know if a lot of folks that listen to our podcast know kind of what that entails. Can you fill us in a little bit on maybe the agreement that's made between the artist and the gallery and how things are shown?
Yeah. So the gallery game is a rough game. It sounds great. Like when I first started, I was like, I need to get in the highest galleries in town. I need to be in the best things. But most galleries want to put a 50% markup on it. So if you're selling something for $1,000, they want to sell it for $2,000. So if you want to pay yourself a livable wage and meet within what people's perceived values are or what they think a coffee table should cost, like they might think a coffee table at a gallery, and gallery shoppers are pretty savvy. So they understand the game and they know that they're going to pay more at a gallery than if they bought it directly from me. But they're buying it because they went to the gallery's Friday art walk or whatever. So they know. So it's okay to be a little bit high, but I have found that the salary that I want to make per piece that I sell does not allow for a gallery to put a 50% markup on it to meet that perceived value. It way overshoots it. So like I want to sell a desk for $8,000. Well, that's $16,000 once the gallery puts it on it. So it doesn't work very well. So I've tried to negotiate like, hey, how about a 30% commission? But then the gallery is not motivated to show your stuff. Mm-hmm. When the gallery's owners there is taking their client around, they're not as motivated to show your stuff, or your stuff gets pushed to the back or whatever. So the gallery game is really tough. The thing that I have found that works best for the gallery game is just to accept the fact that they're going to take 50% and then build things specifically for the gallery. Mm. So that way, like if I'm going to do a desk, it's going to be like a writing desk that's going to only have one drawer because drawers take forever, or it won't have a drawer. It'll be a little table. It'll be something that I can domino together very quickly. And then it'll have some kind of ornamentation that I can do fairly quickly to make it stand out in the gallery, because you can build a table and it's a $1,000 table. But if you do some kind of marquetry or inlay in it, now it's a $10,000 table. So that's the deal. And then there's all kinds of different galleries. Some of the lower end galleries, I've had good luck with some of the lower end galleries not selling some of my high end stuff. But you know, when you make a mistake and you've got all this time involved, you can send that to a lower end gallery and they'll sell it. And you can at least recoup some of your cost or something.
Interesting. And so how long will a gallery let a piece sit in their showroom before they say, hey, come pick this up, nobody's buying it?
That depends on the owner and what they have coming in. In the furniture world, if you build a table, the gallery owner will let it sit in there indefinitely, forever and ever and ever, because she will just use it to display other works of art on it. So it works out well for them. And when that happens, I will get some kind of plastic doodad like this thing to ask the gallery owner if I could put that on there with a information sheet about the table, so that way people know the table's for sale, not just that the gallery's just using it. And then wall space, like when I do clocks, they try to get that to turn fairly fast, or otherwise they're going to tell you to come pick it up, because painters are competing for that wall space. Photographers are competing for that wall space. And then if you do get the gallery to allow you to bring in something for wall space, they want a collection of things, so that way they can make a collage. You can't just bring in like one clock. It's got to be like 8 different clocks or something like that. So that way it's a collage. And then when it gets down to the last 2 or 3, if it's sold fast, they want you to replace that inventory quickly and do a new collage, or you got to come pick up the last 3 that didn't sell.
That's interesting. I mean, I've not been a part of, as an artist, the game of selling stuff through a gallery. I've never been a part of that. I've been on the other side. I worked for an architectural firm that had a gallery in front of our office, and we did it as a cool supporting the arts thing every month. No, it wasn't every month. It was every quarter we would do a gallery opening, and we would pay for, you know, call it the wine and cheese stuff, right? And then we would allow artists for free to come and display their stuff. So we would do the opening for them. We would do a little bit of promotion. So we would give them, call it 1,000 postcards or something if they wanted to send them out. And then anything they sold was 100% theirs. And for a pretty good stretch, we had a group of artists, you know, that word gets out, right? Mm-hmm. Hey, this place. And so, you know, we had a little bit of a waiting list there. And, you know, unfortunately, or sometimes somebody might sell a piece or two over the course of a month while they had their stuff displayed, which really isn't a ton of money. And God forbid if somebody went out and framed 30 pieces of artwork, that far exceeds a lot of times what those one or two pieces might bring in. But then we had other artists that just, I mean, it was just one after another. And we would always ask if they sold something that they leave it there for the entirety of the gallery show. And then the folks who bought it could come pick it up. But anyway, totally, completely different perspective. But I guess I share all of that because those opportunities are out there. They do take a little bit more work. And generally when you get in a gallery like that, there's a time limit to it, right? It's a 30-day or a 60-day installation that you do. But it can improve your income.
Yeah.
From the perspective that you don't have to split it so much with the gallery owners.
Yeah, for sure. I wish I knew more places that did that. Another type of gallery that instead of taking 50% is maybe they will just rent you the wall space. Like you have a monthly fee that you pay, and then they still take some kind of commission, like a 10% commission or something like that. But then they rent the monthly wall thing. And I have found that those are the least productive. Because the gallery owner is not there. They're not motivated to really hustle anything for you, because your monthly fee pays their bills. Right. Yeah. They have this 3,000 square foot showroom, and they divide it up amongst however many people they need to make their monthly bills. And then anything else is just gravy on top of that. So those ones I try to steer away another gallery situation that you might find out there is like co-ops. I've had some luck and some unluck with those, because the thing with the co-op is you have to go down there one day a week to work a shift, because you're a part owner of this thing and you have to help run it now.
Yeah.
And that kind of sucks, because you can go weeks without selling anything. And so instead of being in my shop building stuff, I'm just standing around hoping to sell something. And if it's not like a advertised like Friday Art Walk, First Friday Art Walk, or here in Old Colorado City, they have the cherry blossom blooms or whatever Art Walk and a few other ones. But if it's not one of those, the traffic's pretty light.
Yeah. I worked at a firm that did a lot of corporate interiors, and to the point that, you know, you're talking, in some instances, they would do a dozen stories of a building, right? A dozen floors of a building at the same time. And they had to find artwork to hang. So, you know, paintings or photographs or some type of two-dimensional media. But then they would also buy sculpture, and then they would buy tables and other things to display said sculpture on. And they would, we had one art buyer that worked with us who would literally go out and sometimes have $1 million. And,
Wow. And
you know, from a company, and say, you know, here's your $1 million, go spend $1 million on artwork, and we'll see you in a month when you've found us the stuff we want. And, you know, you're talking, again, massive corporate buildings that they had to outfit with these things. And I've always thought to myself, my goodness, you want to talk about shooting fish in a barrel, you just got to be in the right gallery at the right time when that guy walks in, right?
Right.
He traveled, you know, probably 8-9 months out of the year, and he traveled internationally to find artwork, but I never did get to sit down with him and discuss how he did what he did. Like, where was he going? Was he working with archivists and other art buyers, or how did this all go down? But I think we'd all like to know the answer to that question. But I want to go back a little bit and talk about the art fair and trade show side of things.
Okay.
One of the things that I've noticed, the trade shows that we've done, is that things that would never sell on our website, or very rarely sell on our website, people will buy at the trade shows. And the one example that I have is we sell t-shirts. I probably have one on now. Yeah, I do. A Skyscraper Guitars t-shirt. We sell t-shirts on our website, and we might sell one t-shirt every 2 months. It's like no t-shirt sales at all. And, you know, it's always like, I don't know. There are companies I buy from, and I'll buy their t-shirts just because I think it's, you know, it's like, yeah, I like their products. I'm happy to wear their t-shirt either in the YouTube videos that I do, or just kind of out and about, whatever. And anyway, nobody ever buys our t-shirts on our website, but we show up to trade shows with t-shirts. And that is probably, I don't know if it's our number one best-selling item, but it's definitely in the top two or three. And anyway, I keep saying we're only going to have to go to trade shows for like 10 more years with our t-shirts to get rid of all of them. Because I thought at one time, I'm like, oh, for sure, people, you know, people will buy t-shirts. But anyway, it's kind of funny how that works. But I think there's, in the woodworking world, or in the making world, it doesn't necessarily have to be woodworking, I have a feeling if you sell things on a website, the things that you would sell at an art fair or a trade show would be maybe different than you might think.
Yeah. Oh, I have that same experience, not with t-shirts, with just other things like cutting boards. I have cutting boards listed on my website. I may have sold like two off my website, but I go to an art show or craft show, I will sell all the cutting boards that I had, which is weird because there are five other guys selling cutting boards.
Yeah.
So I think that's something good also we should talk about, on how you handle yourself at trade shows.
Mm.
I did this wine tasting. We have here in the Colorado Springs area, we have a kind of a fancy thing called the Flying Horse Steakhouse, or Flying Horse something or other over there. I don't know, but they do a wine show every year. And me and my buddy went down there. He does hand carved bowls with like an ads, like old school, like not just like a little chip knife, but like old school, oh, wow. like adds out these hand carved bowls. And so we went down there and we negotiated with the people to be not in the room with all the other vendors, to be at the front door. Like we wanted our booth to be at the front door. Mm-hmm. So we were the first guys in that you talk to, and we were the last guys you talk to when you're drunk and leave, because it's wine tasting. So people, and it's a paid event. Yeah, I think you pay like $50 and you get to go around and taste all the wines or whatever. And so we negotiated our spot up front. And so we talked to everybody, made sure we greeted everybody with a big smile. Like we were the welcoming committee. This is what we do. We're woodworkers. We build this stuff. And we were selling stuff going in, and then we were selling stuff as people were going out. And there was another woodworker that I think was very pissed off that we were up front and he was way in the back, because this guy, I didn't realize who he was at first, but this guy came and was looking at all my cutting boards, looking at the prices or whatever. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm trying to sell him a cutting board. And he was like grumpy. He was like, I got lots of cutting boards. And then he like stormed off. And so then later in the show, I went to walk around just to check out all the booths and stuff, and left my friend there to babysit our booth, which is a really good idea to do a trade show with a friend. So that way,
yes,
there's always someone there, nothing gets stolen. And there's always someone there to talk to somebody if you need to go to the bathroom or want to take a break or whatever, or grab something to eat. But anyway, so I go around and I realize that, oh, that grumpy bastard is the guy, is the another woodworker back here in the corner selling cutting boards as well. And that's why he was so grumpy. And then this lady comes back as she's leaving later on that day. And she's like, I just want to let you know, I bought my cutting board from you, 'cause you weren't grumpy like the guy back there. So, yeah, make sure you're in a good mood, because it will affect your sales.
Well, and you know, kind of piggybacking off of that, Brian, I would tell you that a lot of people in a situation where there are a bunch of booths or a bunch of stands or tables or whatever it is that are set up, it's like sociology or psychology 101, right? It's this weird human experiment that people are out of their element. Some people are introverts, some people are extroverts. Some people are like, they want to talk to people, but they're afraid to ice break the conversation. And as the vendor, it is important to, like you said, smile at people, but then say, hey, do you have any questions about anything? I'll be happy to answer them, and not be pushy. Like, here's a cutting board to buy. You know, that, right. That never works. But hey, is there anything, any questions I can answer for you? And a lot of people will, And the question back can be, well, do you have any questions about the woods that you're seeing? Because they're kind of unique and they all have a story to them. And somebody may not be in the market to buy anything from you, and they may not have the money to or care to, but they might be interested in hearing the story about the wood. Where there's a sort of, what do I want to say, like a secondary effect of that is the people around also hear that same story. And I can't tell you how many times I've been talking to someone that I can tell isn't going to buy something from me, and I don't care. I'm there anyway, whether mm-hmm. they're buying something or whether I'm staring off into space, I'm there. So you might as well have a fun conversation and not worry about it. And so, you know, hey, you know, whatever. And somebody else will hear what we're talking about, and they didn't realize that this tool was used in a certain way, or this works on this kind of guitar, or, you know, whatever it is. And they'll hear and they'll come over, and it's interesting how you'll see that secondary and tertiary effect of just having simple conversations with people, not trying to be Mr. Pushy Sales Guy or anything like that. That's not in my blood anyway. I just can't do, mm-hmm. I can't be the slicer dicer guy. But the other thing that I've learned, and I would assume it's very similar in the woodworking business, if you put something in someone's hands, like everybody's afraid to touch things because they see a price tag and they're afraid to touch it. Everything that I've got out on my booth is a display, right? I take a lot of my personal tools and put them out because I don't care if somebody drops it on the floor and puts a dent in it or rubs it the wrong way and takes some finish off. I, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter to me. But when somebody's on the fence about something, I don't know. I go, here, just put one in your hand. And if you're making quality things, you know, the first thing somebody does when they see one of your tables and they know they can touch it is they rub the surface. They want to see what that finish is like.
Mm-hmm,
they don't 100%. Know what exactly what they're looking for, but when they feel it, they're like, oh, you know, that's the reaction. And so one of the common things I do is I say, here, just put it in your hand, you know, just feel this thing. The stuff we make, I'm proud of. Like it's high quality stuff. The finish and fit are like, you know, we want them to be 10 out of 10. Sometimes they're 9 out of 10, but they go in a different pile. If they're 9 out of 10, they get sold for a discount. Mm-hmm. But when you put one in somebody's hands, they're like, oh, now I get it. You know, you can see the light bulb go off. And if they were on the fence in any way, shape, or form, they're probably going to lead more toward the yes once you put it in their hand. If you don't put it in their hand, there's a really, really maybe 99% chance they walk away without buying it. And maybe they don't come back to the website to buy it either. A lot of those people, you have a one shot at it. And I'm not saying this because I want to sell things to people that don't need them, right? That I think is like, we have enough of that in the world. Go into mm-hmm. Walmart. That's Walmart, right? The whole store. Not, I shouldn't say 3/4 of the store is stuff that you don't need. A quarter of it is food and stuff to keep your car running, and those things are good. But if I can tell, like, this guy is he's a repair guy. He's told me that he's having trouble with a certain thing. It would benefit this person to have one of these tools. They just may not have fully comprehended that yet. I do like to help them with that. I'm sure, again, back to woodworking, I'm sure there's similar things there.
Yeah. I always try to tell people a little something about, like, oh, I use this type of chemical to create this effect or something. And they have no idea unless they're a chemist, which has happened before. Then all of a sudden I'm flipped into like learning mode, like, oh, you're a chemist and you know what I'm talking about. Like, all right, now let's get deep. But for the most part, most people don't know or have any kind of clue what that chemical is or what it does or how it reacts or anything like that. They're just like, huh, that's interesting. And it just kind of gets people talking and looking, and they spend a little more time in your booth before they move on. And hopefully they will take your business card and remember that interaction.
I wonder too, one thing I have never done, I'm not a big, I think the term is SEO guy, where you track on your website, how many people clicked on your website at what time and where did they come from? And, you know, mm-hmm. how many kids do they have or whatever it'll tell you. I've never been that guy, but I would be interested to see, you know, it would be awesome to be able to do something to your business card where you could tell this is a unique individual coming to our website from this particular, you know, what percentage of the people who take your business card ever check you out, ever give it a second thought?
I can answer that for you.
Okay, good.
I am that SEO guy, not to the crazy extent that some people get into it because I have to build things. I can't read the report all day, but I have tracked that when I go and I give my business card and I hand somebody my business card and says, here, call me or whatever. But I know you get a lot of these, but before you throw it away, at least check out my website, right? Uh-huh. Like, I'll make a little joke out of it. Before you throw it in the garbage, at least check out my website. And after the shows, there is an uptick up. And I'll say that for every 1,000 business cards I hand out, I'm using 1,000, not that I always hand out 1,000, but the 1,000 makes it easy math. Every 1,000 business cards I hand out, I will get 100 hits to my website. Maybe 3 or 4 people will inquire and 1 person will buy, but it takes 1,000 to move the needle. So you have to talk to a lot of people.
So that's interesting that you say it that way, 1 out of 1,000, because when we track sales on YouTube videos, that's about the sales that we get is 0.1%.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a YouTube video about something that you're selling and 1,000 people watch it, 1 person will buy. So if you have 100,000, then 100 people are probably buying your stuff. And that's been a fairly consistent number over the past, whatever decade that I've been on YouTube and selling things. Now, in the guitar world, I don't know if I've gone and done those numbers on skyscraper guitars, but I did Greg's Garage when I've done things on there. I sell some pens and squares and Seems Impossible tools and some other things. Those are the numbers that we tend to see as a 0.1%. So that's interesting that it equates to business cards as well.
Yeah, well, and that's also like I've paid for Google Click ads, the Click ads, and I've also tried Facebook Click ads. And the first time that did not hold true, my budget was like, poof, like gone super fast. There, you got to beat the bots in that game and have your keywords very, very dialed in to be so targeted that you don't think anybody's searching for that word. So that way your money doesn't get eaten up by the bots. And Google and Facebook will never admit that they allow bots to run up your tab. But like, I've had just like $100, just like boom, within a few minutes, just be gone, just because like no way that many people search for that term or whatever. But Click ads, same kind of thing. About 1,000 clicks will result in a sale.
Interesting. Well, that's probably some good information for everybody out there. Well, let's see. Thinking about any other, let's talk logistics for half a second. That's something that I think your first art fair or trade show, you get a master class in logistics.
Yeah.
You see someone show up that has been to 1,000 trade shows or art fairs that has everything down to a science, and their booth is up and operational in about 5 minutes while you're still hauling in milk crates from the bed of your truck one at a time because you can't carry them all. What have you learned in terms of logistics for getting set up for something like that?
So this is a thing.
It is.
Yeah. So that goes back to my thing. If you have a friend like that will come with you, help you, or enlist my kids or somebody or something, that is huge to have another person. But I have done a lot of shows by myself. One of the biggest learning ones was an outdoor show, and they encouraged people they were providing security for the night before, but they were encouraging people to bring your pop-up and find your space the night before. But I couldn't go in the night before because my daughter had a soccer game. And of course, you know, I'm soccer dad, so I couldn't go to the night before. So I had to show up in that early that morning, and I thought, well, I'll just show up extra early, it'll be fine. There was no way to be able to back my truck in anywhere to unload furniture or anything. I had to park a block up the street and dolly with my furniture dolly all my stuff in. So get in early, and if they say you should set up the night before, like, that's a huge thing, to bring some of your stuff in and get your stuff set up and whatever. And here in Colorado, outdoor stuff is risky can be, because man, we have some crazy thunderstorms that just appear out of nowhere from the mountains. Someone coughed up on the top of Pike's Peak, and then all of a sudden there's a thunderstorm. I don't even know, but like, we got some crazy weather here.
Well, that's to kind of push that a little further. One thing that we've learned, some venues have tables and chairs that are part of your booth. Some do not. And so you have to factor that in. And if they are providing tables and chairs, then the question is, what kind of table and chair? Is it a table that looks like it's just been destroyed? Or is it going to be in decent enough shape? And then are the chairs like a folding metal chair, folding plastic chair that after you've sat in it for 12 hours, you're realizing what a bad idea it was to not bring your own chairs. We've had kind of all of the above, but one of the things, a handful of the things we've learned, always bring tablecloths to cover up your tables, because they look so much nicer if it's just kind of blacked out. Even if it's just, you can go to Walmart and get like a bed sheet, and not the fitted one, whatever they call it, the flat. Get a flat bed sheet and at least cover your table up, and it can be colorful. It doesn't have to be black, but something. And then, two-wheel dolly. And one of those, it's almost like a fold up wagon. I don't know what to call it, but people take them to soccer games and stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Got one of those.
And they have ones with like these big all terrain wheels on them. And those are the ones to get. because you don't know how many curbs you're going to be going up and over. And you're obviously going to try and stack as much stuff up as you can to take it in as few loads as you can. And your advice on getting there early so that you can get a parking spot that you don't have to walk a mile with your stuff and through the parking lot with the potholes and all the things. Those have been very important. But then on the personal side of things, bring a cooler with some drinks and some snacks in it, because every place that we've been to do something like that, oh yeah, there's food, there's this or that. And it's almost impossible to get away from your booth when it's feeding time, because that's when everybody's there.
Mm-hmm.
And so just being able to grab a cheese stick or a handful of almonds or a granola bar, or, whatever it is, something that you have, you know, we've been caught. I'm remembering back to one day where we started at like 7 a.m. and ended at 4, and I didn't have a bite to eat or anything to drink all day. And it was like, you know, it was brutal.
You were dying. I bet. Yeah.
Yeah. And so just, you know, a soft-sided cooler with just a couple things in there to keep you going. Cause at these things, you're most people, not everyone, is standing for a good part. I mean, anytime you have a customer in the booth, you're probably standing, shaking hands, doing whatever, just whatever for that presence.
Yeah, bring a chair to sit on to rest, but I would caution against sitting at the chair.
Yeah.
Because like when I walk by someone else's booth, and if I'm interested in their thing, and I just see this person there with their RBF, and I'm guilty of it too. I have terrible RBF, but
resting Brian face.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I'd look like a grumpy ass old man sitting there sometimes if I'm not careful, looking at my phone or something, looking pissed off. But even though I'm not, but like, yeah, so you don't want to look all, you want to look inviting. So if you can stand up as much as you can during the day and smile and greet people, even if they're not coming into your booth, just say, hey, how's it going? You know, where you're from, whatever, just small talk as they're walking by will help the day pass better and increase your sales by a lot, for sure.
Yeah. One other tiny logistic thing. I saw you had an acrylic stand with your postcards on it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things, and this is common to see at like car shows and things like that, but we always bring a big roll of paper towels and a thing of Windex, and anything that has a speck of dust on it, we sit and clean it, because it's amazing when your stuff is very clean and presentable. It just catches that little bit of reflection when people walk by, and it kind of glimmers at folks. And it is important. That was one that we learned. I'm trying to remember when we did that. But anyway, just a thing of Windex or some kind of cleaner and some paper towels is a super smart thing to have.
Yeah. Adam Savage had a podcast that he talked about greeting people like you're going to shake a lot of people's hands when you're in a situation like a show or something. And so he's like trained himself so he doesn't want to get sick. Right. So he will. Like your natural tendency is to touch your face, right? So he's trained himself to shake with his, you know, dominant hand and then scratch with his non-dominant hand. So that way he's not like constantly touching his face with after shaking 100 people's hands. So yeah, Windex to clean your hands as well as throughout the day.
Some hand wipers. That's probably a smart thing.
Something.
One of the other things we had this year, I wound up having two different sets of things. One was a display and one was a new piece that I was kind of debuting at this guitar show. And both of them were like right at elbow level when I was standing. So if there was a long conversation, I could almost lean on them. And, you know, if you're standing for 6 hours and you're not used to, there's a difference between moving for 6 hours and standing in one place for 6 hours. And I'm sure you've seen this in your shop. You know, as long as you're mobile, your feet do a lot better. Mm-hmm. When you stand somewhere for, let's call it a solid 15 or 20 minutes and have a conversation and you don't move, it can start to weigh on your feet just a little bit. But I wound up having a couple things in our booth at opposite ends of our booth. We had 2 8-foot-long tables. So it was 16 foot long. It's big space. But I had two things that I could kind of lean on and just take a little pressure off. And I was like, I have to remember this for next year, because it was just the type of thing, you know, after 5 or 6 hours kind of standing around, it was like, okay, I could use just that little, you know, 15-pound break on my feet. So kind of
Cushy pad to stand on. So two things. one to step back to your tablecloth thing. I found some that are fitted for a folding card table, and they are tapered with some elastic so you can wrap it around the feet. So that way your whole table just looks like this nice black presenter thing. And then the other thing is point of sale and Wi-Fi. Like, make sure some places will charge you for Wi-Fi. Yeah. If you want to hook up Wi-Fi, if you need electricity for a display, they charge you extra for a booth that has electricity run to it. So yeah, make sure you got your Square card reader thing. Not to knock PayPal or anything, but if your Square card reader breaks, you can go to Best Buy and buy one. If your PayPal's card reader breaks, you're SOL. But my new phone, this is the Google Pixel, whatever the newest Google Pixel is. It has a sensor, like a touch sensor, like you go to the grocery store. So you just touch the card there and it'll charge the card.
Ah.
Built into the phone.
I need to look into that. I hope I'm not being disparaging here. In the past, we've always used PayPal for point of sale.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, we were at a show 1 week before they discontinued. Well, it was less than a week. It was the last weekend that their technology was going to be available. And I don't know what happened, but we were able to use it for about the first half hour, and then it just became an absolute nightmare. And it would tie up the computer. We do it, our sales off of an iPad. It would tie up the iPad and wouldn't let it go through. And it was awful. Okay, we need to have a new format here. And so we moved to Square this year. And this past weekend was the first event that we were using Square, and the Square card reader would not work. And just as a whatever piece of advice out there, if the card reader doesn't work, most card reading whatever applications, people, companies have a way to key the card in manually. So we had to key in every single sale manually. Thank God I had Andrea there. She is my wife, for those who don't know, but she is an absolute saint, and she sat there and entered every single person's card numbers by hand and made sure all the sales were correct.
Yeah, unfortunately, they take an extra percentage. Yeah. So, can I ask what was wrong with the card reader? Why what stopped working about it?
I have no idea. It lit up like it's supposed to. It was connected by Bluetooth like it was supposed to. But every time we would put a card in, it would sit there and say processing for as long as you would let it sit there. So we did one for like 5 minutes, and it's like, okay, we're giving up the ship here.
I wonder if it didn't have enough Wi-Fi.
You know, I thought the same thing, but then I got on YouTube and was like, no, it's playing videos in real time at high def.
Yeah.
I think we've got enough bandwidth. And when you would key them in manually, it'd go just fine. Like no problems. So I don't know. There's something in the software. We use a backend called Equid, which some days it's awesome. Some days it's a little sus, and I'm not saying that it does a wonderful job at the things it does, but when you ask it to do things that may be a little bit off the menu, which tying into a Square reader, which they say they can do, it may not have been Square at all. It may have been 100% pay or 100% Equid's fault, but either way, whatever it was, it wasn't a great experience. So I'm going to set up a call with Square next week and just see
what happened. Yeah. Cause that sucks. That's money out of your pocket by not being able to, swipe the card, or now what do they call it? Dip the card or tap the card.
Tap. Yeah.
But,
cause it had all the magical, you know, whatever they call that, the tapping abilities. I have another show coming up, in June that I'm going to do. So I've got to get it sorted out before.
Yeah, or get a Google Pixel so you can just
yeah. I don't want to go down the Square rabbit hole, but in order to do some of the Square point of sale stuff, they want you to have your sales part of your website go through them. Well, no, not even the sales part. I think they want your whole website to go through them in some instances. And I'm not ready to give up that kind of control. I've talked to some of their tech guys about not doing it that way, and they said they can help. But anyway,
yeah, if you want to track track inventory.
Maybe
that's the thing, that you need to have your inventory loaded into Square. And if someone buys from your website, because that's how I have mine, is that if someone buys it from my website, it takes it out of my inventory. If someone buys it from a show, it takes it out of the inventory. So that way nobody can accidentally overpurchase.
Yeah.
Or in theory. But Square's malfunction did get me a sale a few years ago. One thing, it might have been what caused it, is that if you use the phone and tap the phone and say connect to Bluetooth, it might or might not connect to the Square reader. But if you go into the Square reader app and then tell it to connect to Bluetooth, then it connects 100% every time. But I was at a soccer tournament for my daughter, because, you know, soccer dad here. And I went to the food truck, and the lady's having a hard time with the Square connecting to her phone. And I says, oh, I have that same problem with my business. And I have to go through the app to connect it, not just the phone. And then she's like, oh, so then she tried it and it worked. And the guy behind me is like, oh, what do you do? So I gave him one of my business cards and then sold him a dining room table a week later. So thank you, Square, for fucking up so I can make a sale.
I thought you were gonna say she was having trouble with her phone connecting to her Square, so you connected your phone to it and took one of her taco sales.
Oh no, I would never do that. Yeah, no. I'm not a taco salesman, but I am a consumer of tacos.
Oh yeah,
but who isn't? So that whole thing just turned out to be a great thing for just making small talk to the guy behind me while we're waiting for our food.
Well, there's a good tip for everybody, is you have to be a salesman all the time if you're going to be in business for yourself doing stuff like this. You have to be a consummate salesman, and you have to be your largest cheerleader, because nobody else is going to do
it. No one else is going to do it for you. Yeah, weird things have happened like that before. I was in an elevator going up to a loft. This was when I was living in Portland, Oregon. And some guy gets in the elevator with me, and he's like, oh, that's a cool table. And I says, yeah, I built it for one of your neighbors. And I gave him my card, and then he bought a credenza from me a couple months later. So
always
have your business card on you.
Well, Brian, we've been chatting for about an hour. We can probably wrap up here. This was some good information. I learned some things here today too, about galleries and how they operate. And, you know, of course, everybody's trade show and art fair stories are a little bit different, but I think it's just great information for everybody out there who's thinking about dipping their toes into that arena. And is it worth it? Is it worth it for me? And, you know, how else am I going to sell things at volume?
Yeah, volume, or even just get your name out there for future sales, for sure. All right. Well, so you want to take us out?
I can. I am Greg Porter. Thanks for joining us. You can find me at skyscraperguitars.com or gregsgaragekc.com.
And I am Brian Benham, and you can find me on all the social apps as Benham_design. And you are listening to the Maker's Quest podcast. If you want to catch any of our old episodes, you can go to themakersquest.com. Thanks for listening.